Today is July 23rd, 2009. I'm here in Singapore with Kishore Mahbubani, Dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. Professor Mahbubani, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
I was wondering if we could start with me asking you to share your views on the role of the initial leadership group here in Singapore, how they've shaped the country's development, what role they've played.
Well, I think it's clear Singapore would not be where it is today without the exceptional set of founding leaders we had. I mean, I'll just mention three, Lee Kuan Yew, Goh Keng Swee, and Rajaratnam, but there were others, Toh Chin Chye, Yong Nyuk Lin, Eddie Barker, and later on, the finance minister, whose name suddenly I drew a blank on, but Hon Swee Sen, who was very good. Hon Swee Sen. So, anyway, and what is amazing about these leaders was their determination and their drive. Okay, they knew that Singapore was in a tough spot. They knew that Singapore had very few options, and so they were extremely realistic, very grounded, very down to earth, and looked for simple, pragmatic solutions to any problem. They didn't bring any ideology to the table at all. So even though they came in as left-wing socialist government, they realized from day one that they needed to get foreign direct investment. So Dr. Goh Keng Swee instructed his staff, find me a factory to open every day. So even if it's a small coffee-making factory or zinc roof factory, he didn't care. He said, just take me to the factory. I want people to see I'm opening factories, give people hope that there's economic development taking place. And so they, whatever they decided to put in place, a kind of investment management regime that basically provided a one-stop shopping for all foreign investors. And if you had any problems, you need workers, you needed to, how do you say, get more flexible tax reliefs and everything, all that was taken care of in one shot. But I think when they started off, none of them even dreamt that Singapore would be as successful as it is today. So it shows you, basically what Singapore shows is that if you put the right policies in place at the very beginning, right? You plant the right seeds, you get a very powerful tree that comes 40 years later.
So looking back now, you've mentioned the economic policies and the focus on foreign direct investment. Are there other policies that strike you as really crucial in that initial period that set the stage for subsequent developments?
Well, I think they're not necessarily in order of priority, okay? But the economic development policies were critical. The multiracial policies were very critical. They made sure that all ethnic groups were treated equally. And as a correlation to that, they had a policy of meritocracy, which means that they didn't care what race you were. If you were good, they tried to train and develop you. The defense policy was critical because you had to make sure that Singapore was safe and not vulnerable to attacks and so on and so forth. And also the see, economics, multiracial, meritocracy, defense. And education. They put an incredible amount of emphasis on education. That's why I think arguably Singapore has the best public education system in the world today. Not necessarily private education, public education system.
Now with each of these priorities, there are obviously resource commitments, and obviously the situation then was very different to the situation now in terms of available resources. So sacrifices had to be made. I was wondering, do you have a sense of what those hard bargains were? Obviously, I imagine there are a lot of things the government wanted to do, but the things that fell by the wayside.
Well, I think for a start, as you know, the one thing the government's realistic about was public finances, and they always believe you cannot spend more than you earn, And that's also why they also had a policy of zero subsidies for any industry, because they realized that, you know, Singapore doesn't have oil resources to subsidize inefficient industries. I remember very early on, in the early 1970s, Singapore, there was a German investment. If I'm not mistaken, it's a camera company, Leica, L-E-I-C-E, maybe I'm mistaken. It was a German camera company that invested in Singapore. So 300 engineers were sent for training to Germany. They came back, they set up a factory and all that. Then after a couple of years, discovered they couldn't compete with the Japanese. So the factory was shut down. And the 300 engineers were deployed elsewhere. They didn't think that, oh, we've trained 300 engineers in Germany, we've got to keep on supporting it. They just shut it down. And they were quite brutal in that sense. They also believed in, as you know, they had a very tough-minded view on strikes. They believed that strikes, the British disease of strikes, would kill Singapore. Because if you allow the strikes to continue, there'd be no foreign investment. So they worked very hard to create a tripartite partnership with employers, workers, and the companies, you know, on wage policy. And over time, this policy worked. And the reason why this policy worked was that every year the workers would get increase in wages. So as long as they were getting increase in wages, the workers were happy to go along.
Yeah. So if overall economic development facilitated that tripartite understanding you mentioned, there were other aspects of policy that were, to use your word, brutal. I know that was, but pragmatic, hard. Mm. I mean, they're harsh, for example. Mm. Hard political sells. What about the leadership allowed them to carry the public along with them on that?
I think one is results. Because, I mean, if you see, I remember when I grew up as a child in Singapore, in the 1950s and early 1960s, there was poverty, there was unemployment, there were riots. You know, in front of my house, there would be gangster fights, and I would see one gangster chasing another gangster with a broken beer bottle with blood streaming from their bodies, you know. So, you know, it was a rough and tough third world city in some ways. Then suddenly you had law and order, economic growth, jobs. And you know, I grew up in a relatively poor neighborhood, and in that poor neighborhood, many were unemployed, you know. But those were my age and above, all of them started getting jobs. I mean, they didn't go to university, but they got jobs and they began to lead much more comfortable lives. And so, once you get when you see improvement in your life, you support the government. And the government also was also in, I'm going to use the word brutal very often, brutally honest with their population. They didn't try to sugarcoat or soften the messages in any way. They said, we only have hard choices in Singapore, and we must be ready to make hard choices. We have no soft options. And so the population was, in a sense, educated into the realities of Singapore.
Now, part of the turbulence of the 1950s was this multiracial composition of the island that you mentioned earlier. Could you speak a little bit more about the challenge Singapore faces in terms of coming together as a nation, both on the island itself and in terms of the regional aspects that complicated this significantly?
Well, I mean, on the island itself, there had been ethnic riots in Singapore within the Malays and Chinese, and in many cases, you see that the Chinese are a majority in Singapore, but a minority in Malaysia and Indonesia, and because they are a minority in Malaysia and Indonesia, the Chinese and populations in Malaysia and Indonesia have to be very careful, you know, politically in what they say and what they do and so on and so forth. So the Chinese in Singapore could see what was happening across in Malaysia and Indonesia, and so realized that they were much better off in Singapore. And at the same time, frankly, the government wisely decided that you had to also make the Malay population feel that they're also part of Singapore too. And they worked very hard to integrate the Malay population the success of Singapore. And you know, this is a large part of this, by the way, is not wholesale work but retail work. You know, it's what you do on the ground, constituency by constituency, mosque by mosque, that makes a big difference. You know, and for example, you know, like the government encouraged the setting up of various self-help units, you know, for the Chinese, for the Indians, for the Malays, and supported them, you know. And so every group felt they was part of Singapore's growth story.
Now, as I understand it, the majority of the leadership, and this is of course reflective of the society as a whole, were ethnic Chinese, and also just think British educated. Ethnic Chinese was a hardcore. How did they deal with this issue of a multiracial society coming from the majority ethnic population? How did they try to bridge that gap, the role of individual leaders, say like Lee Kuan Yew?
Well, I think they led by example. For a start, the in the cabinet already, I mean, there are various things Singapore did. No? I mean, they learned a lesson, for example, from Sri Lanka. A lot of the ethnic fighting in Sri Lanka began when Sri Lanka, as you know, abolished the Tamil language and made Sinhalese the sole national language. And Sri Lanka, Ceylon was a great hope of Asia. And Singapore, they said, okay, let's have four official languages. So in your income tax forms, you get in English, Mandarin, Malay, Tamil. And there are four official languages on radio. And you could learn your language in school, so there's no suppression of language at all. And in the pledge that Rajaratnam wrote, the foreign minister, who was another very brave man, he emphasized the need for all races to be part of Singapore family. And you know, once you do that, you tell everybody, you know, you're all equal. There's no discrimination at all, in any kind. It creates a sense of commitment. Plus, you see, people saw that in schools, in every sector, that if you were good, didn't matter what race you were from, right? They saw Malays succeeding, they saw Indians succeeding, said, okay, we all have equal options, equal opportunities.
Now, you mentioned meritocracy. So this issue of meritocracy and the integrity of the public sector here in Singapore is something that's really defined the story. But that, looking back at the colonial legacy, that was never a preordained result. There was no reason why Singapore had to emerge as this shining paragon. Could you talk a little bit about what made that possible? What you think is that?
I think the great advantage of the first generation leaders is that they read a lot. They read a lot of books. I was amazed how many books Dr. Goh Keng Swee read. For example, whenever Dr. Goh Keng Swee is put in charge of an organization, the first thing he does, he said, find me the best books on this area, whatsoever and so on. So he began to study why organizations succeed. And so he came across, he said, why Shell Company, for example, a very successful company? So he went to investigate. Then he discovered the reason why Shell Company succeeded is because they had a policy of recruiting the best. And then even after recruiting the best, you assume that not everybody is equal. So you try to identify within 5 years of employment who are on the fast track and put them on the fast track and get them to the top as fast as possible, those the medium track and slow track. And so there were mathematical formulas for doing this, you know. So Singapore basically copied the Shell formula. You know, Shell, for example, said you should be promoted on the basis of your current estimated potential, CEP. So that if you, let's say you join at the age of 25 or 22, and then they say, okay, by 30 they know that you are going to be a CEO. They don't wait till you're 60 to make you CEO, they make you CEO at 45. So the attitude of Dr. Goh Keng Swee was a very pragmatic one. You know, he said to us, he says, whatever problem Singapore faces, somebody somewhere has solved that problem. Go find that solution. Right? So he didn't believe that you had to reinvent the wheel in Singapore. That's why you're always looking to study best practices and copy them. So Singapore is the best copycat nation in the world.
Now, there is an element, again, of brutality to this, this fast-tracking people, because you yourself have lengthy experience in the Foreign Service in that regard, but every time you fast-track someone, there are a lot of people they're jumping over. So Singapore is aggressively meritocratic, I guess you could say. How do you manage the divisive tensions that can result from that, that process?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are tensions, but the critical thing is that when you select people who are the best, you got to ensure that they perform. Because if they don't perform and they do badly, and you keep on rewarding them, then there's trouble. And what they, to give you an example, there's a forced bell curve of the people in the admin service. So the top 10% get promoted very fast. Then the ones in the middle get promoted relatively slower phase. But the bottom 5 or 10% are then told to leave. So if people can see that if you join an exclusive service, it's great. You go up if you perform, but you don't perform, you're thrown out. And then people say, maybe I don't want to be part of that. Because that's, again, part of being brutal, you know, that they actually would remove people who are not performing.
Now, a lot of Singapore's public service talent has been drawn from academia or academic backgrounds over the year.
Well, I mean, they've gone to good universities and got good degrees, but they're not academics.
They're not academics.
No. In fact, very few. In fact, there was a phase when the government experimented with academics and recruited a lot of PhDs and then discovered they were too academic for government. So, and the whole academic experiment failed.
Now, Ronnie, looking at it from the outside, there are obvious some extreme advantages to, I guess, what you could call vertical integration of staffing a civil service. You get them, you identify merit at a very young age and then you fast track it. But it would seem that there are relatively few opportunities to bring accomplished people in at higher levels, at later levels. Is that something that you had encountered? Was that possible?
Well, I think the government tried, you know. They brought in a couple of, in fact, the Singapore Administrative Service tried to bring in people at a higher level. They brought in someone who was recruited from a bank in New York whom I met. And they recruited someone from a company, an entrepreneur. But they didn't survive very long. Because, I mean, there is a certain, every organization has got its corporate culture, you know. And you've got to understand in the Singapore Civil Service is very dynamic, right? But in some ways it's also very conservative, you know. The values are very conservative. You're not supposed to be showy, flashy if you're a civil servant. You're supposed to maintain a low profile and things like that. So that's part of the corporate culture, you know. You perform well, but you don't flaunt it. And so people coming from outside don't understand the particular mix of the corporate culture of the organizations. But that's why they open windows in other ways. You know that if you look at all the leading organizations in which the government has major shareholding. Take Singapore Airlines, the most successful airlines in the world. For the chairmanship, they'll bring in people from outside, right? From the private sector, like Koh Boon Hwee, like Stephen Lee, or take the DBS Bank. Again, Koh Boon Hwee came in and did that. And before that, they got others from outside. Take the NOL shipping company, they got a businessman to come in from outside to run it. So they made sure they brought in people at that level to get fresh ideas and perspectives.
So in one topic of conversation that this corporate culture comes up a lot is when you discuss integrity, the integrity of the service. And it would seem from some conversations I've had that's there's no real structure, no plan for instilling that. It's a socialization, if you will, that comes along. Could you, I know these topics are inherently amorphous, but what is this process of socialization? What's important in the development of that core?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is leadership by example. I mean, you could see that Lee Kuan Yew, Goh Keng Swee, Rajaratnam, were not interested whatsoever in putting money in their own pockets. They were only interested in helping Singapore. So when your leaders are not corrupt, it makes a big difference, you know. You know you're not supposed to be corrupt. Second, the punishment for those who were corrupt was very brutal also. So they, for example, as you know, in very early years, a minister of state, like a deputy minister, was invited by a friend of his to go on holiday, and he said, "Oh, I have no money." And the businessman said, "I'll pay for you, I'll take you away." So he and his family went on holiday with the businessman, and then when he came back, he was arrested, charged, went to court, and went to jail. Not for, you know, he didn't take a bribe to do something wrong. He just accepted a gift, and he's not supposed to accept. If you can't even accept gifts, you know, let alone bribes, then the message gets out very loud and clear.
Now, one part of the Singapore story is that the sustainability, the trajectory has been nearly linear. Not completely, but gone from strength to strength.
It's an amazing... I make the outrageous claim that Singapore is the most successful society in human history in terms of how it has transformed a society in all dimensions, you know, in one generation.
Now, the easy explanation for that is that it's a one-party state and everything can be attributed to that. Because it takes the pressure off the politicians, takes the pressure off the civil servants. Is that fair? Is there more to it? Is there something?
Well, you see, in the Western model, you either have multi-party states or one-party states, and all one-party states are the same. And one thing you discover in the real world that is that there are one-party states and there are one-party states. They are corrupt, self-serving, ruthless, authoritarian one-party states. They are also very honest one-party states that try and put the interests of the society first. And there are one-party states that are closed and therefore controlled by a small mafia. And there are one-party states that are open to getting talent from everywhere possible. And the reason, for example, why China's Communist Party is doing so well nowadays is because they're looking for talent wherever possible. And in Singapore's case, the government has always tried to adopt an inclusive approach. So including people, I can give you several examples. There are people like Ambassador Tommy Koh, who was very critical of the government when he was young. They said, okay, why don't you come inside and find out what it's like? There's Ambassador Chan-Ing Chi, ambassador in Washington, D.C. She was very critical of the government before. Then she became an ambassador and she understood how the government worked. Then there's Minister of Finance, Tharman Shanmugaratnam. When he was in university, also wrote articles that were very critical of the government. Again, they said, come and work in the government, see what it's like. There's Ho Kwang Ping. And by the way, Tharman Shanmugaratnam was actually charged by the government, you know.
Yeah.
Went to court, and despite that, he's now a minister.
The Secrets Act, right?
Official Secrets Act. There's Ho Kwang Ping, who was detained, right? It was a political detainee for a few weeks, and now he's chairman of the Singapore Management University. And so this policy of including everybody is, I think, a very wise policy.
Again, pragmatic.
Yeah, very pragmatic. And so everyone, so you're giving everyone a stake in decision-making and saying, okay, if you think things can be run better, fine, try. We give it to you. And if you do it better, all more power to you.
So this idea that there are one-party states and then there are one-party states goes to the heart of, you could argue, goes to the heart of why Singapore is not referred to more often as a developmental model, because there are very various aspects of it that for whatever reason people deem disqualifier. What would you say deserves to be focused on for countries that are trying to emulate Singapore's success, that find themselves at certain points that Singapore has been at in the past? What are the key concepts, or the, I don't want to get quite down to policy level, but what should be taken from the Singapore story?
Yeah. Well, the two things. One is that the reason why the Western commentators haven't understood Singapore, and here, I've written about this several times, you know, you can please quote me, The reason why the Western mind doesn't understand Singapore is because the Western mind has become a closed mind. The Western mind assumes that there is only one route to development in history, that you have to copy the West to succeed. And if you don't copy the West, you cannot succeed. So when you don't copy the West and you succeed, then you haven't succeeded. And you know, the strange thing is that there are some aspects of the West we all copy, right? In my book, I speak about the seven pillars of Western wisdom that explain why Asia is succeeding. And I think, frankly, I ask all Asian societies to copy the seven pillars of Western wisdom. But in the case of Singapore, what is the takeaway from Singapore? I give a lecture in the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy on the principles of governance in Singapore. And I boil it down. I say, if you want to understand the speed of Singapore's development, understand, remember the acronym MPH, which normally stands for miles per hour, which is a measure of speed, right? So in the case of Singapore, MPH stands for, number one, meritocracy, number two, pragmatism, number three, honesty. And I say that any state in the world that implements MPH brutally will succeed, without exception. And the hardest one is honesty.
The most brutal one is honesty, I guess. Yeah. Well, Professor, thank you very much for taking the time today.
Well, thank you.